My aim in writing Legacy of Ashes was to take the experience I had in covering CIA as a daily newspaper reporter and to see how we as a nation had gotten to the point where we arrived less than 3 years ago, where the President and Congress in their wisdom had decided to abolish the post of Director of Central Intelligence.
Good morning. Let me open with a couple of quick announcements. Radio IQ, which is part of the NPR system, is now broadcasting the first 30 minutes of our forums on Saturday night and Sunday night at 7:30 p.m. First time Saturday and then on Sunday. So our our speakers are being urged to keep their opening remarks to 27 minutes or less, and that's the reason for that. And then for the dialogue with the audience, which goes out on the PBS television version of the show that is now seen on all of the Virginia PBS stations, we do have a full PBS hour, which is 57 minutes and 46 seconds exactly, including credits. But that accounts for the timing and occasionally the effort of the speakers to compress 40 or 50 minutes worth of information. Today, Tim Weiner is going to do 60 years of CIA history in 27 minutes. So it's a challenge. At the end of Tim Weiner's opening comments today, I have invited Fred Hitz, who lives here in Charlottesville, teaches at the university, and was Inspector General of the CIA from 1990 to 1998, to join us up here and start the conversation. On everybody's seat this morning was a copy of the New York Times story, which just moved, which shows that the current director of Central Intelligence is questioning the efficacy and the work of the Office of the Inspector General. And because this is significant and breaking news that Tim Weiner will address, and since Fred Hitz is actually quoted on the page one story, it's appropriate that he join the conversation. Finally, there will be a book signing following Tim Weiner's talk, and I would ask everyone to stay in their seats so that Tim can get out to the front and sign books. And he will be delighted to talk with anyone as they leave, but I do want him to get out there without being held up here. Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Our guest today is Tim Weiner. Tim now is a reporter for the New York Times who specializes in reporting on American intelligence. In 1988, when he was with the Philadelphia Inquirer, he won the Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on a secret Pentagon budget for defense, research, and arms buildup. He has been reporting from around the world on CIA operations, including reporting from Afghanistan in late 2001. His current book, Legacy of Ashes, is his third book. His first book was Betrayal, the story of Aldrich Ames, which was published in 1995 and recounted Ames' conviction for treason as a Soviet mole. And then in 1990, he published Blank Check, the Pentagon's Black Budget, which was based on his Pulitzer Prize-winning articles about the U.S. government's secret budgets to fund military programs. Legacy of Ashes is unique in that it is fully on the record. Anybody who's looked at it will see that there are around 500 pages of text, supported by some 200 additional pages of footnotes. As I say, everything is based on firsthand reporting, examination of over 50,000 documents, many from CIA archives. We just received word that Legacy of Ashes is a finalist for the National Book Award. Please welcome Tim Weiner.
Thank you, George, and thanks to the Miller Center. You all know this, but a wider part of the world needs to know the Miller Center is doing the most extraordinary work in its field of any institution that I'm aware of dealing with public affairs and the public policy of the United States. I'm very grateful to be here. I first set foot inside CIA headquarters nearly 20 years ago, and the story of how I got there is not a bad one to open up with. I had determined in the summer of 1987 that I was going to go to Afghanistan to see what an American covert operation looked like in the country where it was happening. You'll recall the Soviet Army had invaded Afghanistan, occupied it, murdered roughly a million Afghans, and that the United States, through the CIA, and in conjunction with the Chinese and the Saudis and the Egyptians, and the very helpful assistance of the Pakistani intelligence service, which was skimming a good deal of the take, was shipping many hundreds of millions of dollars of arms a year into Afghanistan to bleed the Soviet bear. So I called up CIA and their very helpful public information office. Yes, there is a public information office at the CIA and has been for many, many years. And said, you guys do country briefings for reporters going overseas? No, came up the rather grumpy reply. It was a bad summer, the summer of 87. At CIA, the Iran-Contra hearings were on in full. Bill Casey had just died, leaving a mess behind him. So I went to Afghanistan, had a lovely trip, came back 3 months later. And I hadn't been back in Washington for more than a day when my phone rang. It was the CIA, and now a rather friendly voice saying, Tim, would you like to come in for that briefing now? So I did. And I suspect, as I look out at you, that some of you know this building and know the entryway. It's beautiful. It's grand. Soaring, marble. And on your left as you walk in is an inscription from the Gospel of John, and ye shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free. And on the right are dark stars that memorialize CIA officers who have died in the line of duty. I want to touch briefly today in this talk on the great idea of speaking truth to power, memorialized in that line from the Gospel of John, and on some of those dark stars and how they got there. My aim in writing Legacy of Ashes was to take the experience I had in covering CIA as a daily newspaper reporter, to read every document about CIA that had ever been declassified, and to try and interview every significant senior CIA officer who I hadn't already interviewed in the line of my work. I've tried to write a straightforward chronological narrative history entirely on the record without anonymous sources or blind quotes, and to see how we as a nation had gotten to the point where we arrived less than 3 years ago, where the President and Congress in their wisdom had decided to abolish the post of Director of Central Intelligence. That doesn't happen very often in this country, that we wipe out a position whose office holders have held cabinet rank. I do think it's a tribute to the continuing transparency of American democracy and in a time of secrecy in government that this book could be written at all. And my only regret is that in some quarters it's been perceived as an attack on the CIA. I am not anti-CIA. I am pro-espionage. And my argument is that we're not very good at it, and we need to get good, and we need to get good fast. Why are we not very good at espionage? By which I mean human intelligence gathered by human beings, as opposed to spy satellites, the technological collection of data. I think there are several reasons, and they go to the heart and the soul of CIA. The mission of the CIA really hasn't changed since the agency was created a little over 60 years ago. One, know your enemy. Sun Tzu wrote that 2,600 years ago in The Art of War. Two, provide the United States with strategic warning against a second Pearl Harbor, now a third Pearl Harbor. And third, strategic intelligence. That is to give the President and the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense the information they need to form a strategy for this country, not for tomorrow, not for next week, but over the horizon for months and years to come. We can build all the spy satellites we want, and we try to, at $1 billion a pop or more. And we can build all the electronic eavesdropping stations we can, and we try to. But at the end of the day, and here I'm quoting Richard Helms, Director of Central Intelligence under Presidents Johnson and Nixon, at the end of the day, the only way to know your enemy, the only way to know what another person thinks is to talk to him. And that is the business of spies. And we don't speak the language. And that is a big problem. When the British ran a global empire, they went and lived in the countries that they wanted to command and contain and control. In the Raj, in present-day India and Pakistan and Afghanistan, they lived there for generations. And they learned the lingo, including Pashto, the language of eastern Afghanistan, which the Brits called the language that would be spoken in hell. And their sons and their grandsons, and in many cases their granddaughters, took up the burden of empire. They lived there. They lived there for generations. We don't do generations. We do two-year tours. That's a problem. We don't have a tradition of intelligence in this country. We've only been at it for 60 years. We could use a national intelligence university or its equivalent in this country. There is a scholarship program named for Senator David Boren, who ran the Senate Intelligence Committee 15 years ago, that is designed to teach undergraduates and graduates languages like Pashto, Chinese, Arabic, Korean, Farsi, Hindi, Urdu, and the history and culture of the places where those languages are spoken. The Congress, in its wisdom, funds this at $2 million a year for undergraduates and $2 million a year for graduate students. I submit to you that's pathetic. We can do better than that. Because if we don't know the language, we cannot know the enemy. And intelligence will fail. And when intelligence fails, soldiers die. The second reason I think that we are not very good at espionage in this country is, and this was to me the greatest revelation that I had in doing the research for this book, is the incredibly tortured relationships that presidents have had with the Central Intelligence Agency over the last 60 years. We were talking about the truth and how it sets you free. Well, it takes two people to speak truth to power, one to speak it and one to hear. CIA directors did not always have the facts at hand, and presidents did not always want to hear the facts. And this has led to some serious trouble for the agency and for the United States. Originally, when Harry Truman was persuaded to start up the CIA, having just disestablished the OSS, our wartime civilian intelligence service, what he wanted was a newspaper. He wanted the daily digest of information so he wouldn't have to read a 2-foot-high stack of cables every morning, poor guy. And this was the part of the original intent of CIA. But CIA started out small. It started out weak. It started out against the fervent opposition of the Pentagon and the bitter hatred of J. Edgar Hoover. Hoover wanted to run a worldwide intelligence service, and he was frustrated in that ambition. And for many years thereafter, up to this day, I believe, the FBI and the CIA have been kicking each other in the shins. That's another reason we're not good at espionage. Truman went through four directors of Central Intelligence in a little over 4 years before he finally found General Walter Beadle Smith. Anyone here remember General Walter Beadle Smith? Yeah, Ike's chief of staff during World War II, tough as nails, a great American, and now largely forgotten. I obtained the daily minutes of the director of Central Intelligence meetings with his deputies during the 1950, and a very rich collection of the years during the Korean War when Walter Beadle Smith ran the place. And it's quite clear that General Smith thought that his two most powerful deputies, Alan Dulles and Frank Wisner, the deputy director of Central Intelligence and the chief of the clandestine service, were really pulling the wool over his eyes about the CIA's conduct of covert operations during the Korean War. And well, they might have, given the record. Let me give you a little flavor of what it was like. This is a piece written by very recently by Don Gregg, whom some of you may know. Mr. Gregg spent 31 years in the clandestine service of CIA, serving, among other things, as station chief in Seoul, South Korea, later the United States ambassador to Seoul, indicating just how good a station chief he was, and finally as a national security advisor to Vice President George H.W. Bush. He had joined the Army at 17 in 1945. He was trained as a cryptanalyst, and he went down to Washington to see how he could serve his country when the Korean War broke out. And he was advised to apply to CIA. I'll quote now from this memoir he's written. "What's CIA?" I asked. The reply, "Oh, they jump out of airplanes and they are going to save the world." I immediately applied. And I reported 2 days after my final examination at college, June 1951. A lot of members of the class of 1951 all over this country went to join CIA in the national emergency that was the Korean War. The training I received was a very mixed bag. We worked out of a safe house in Maryland and were introduced to the rudiments of surveillance, dead drops, and secret writing. Our instructors were mediocre at best, and we could never learn what actual experience they had, if any. 12 weeks at the infantry school at Fort Benning came as a vast improvement. We felt we were taught by experts and relished the experience. We were all put under alias, which caused considerable amusement among our Army instructors, as under the stress of parachute training, we forgot what name we were supposed to use. I was interested in Asia and was eventually assigned to the Vietnam desk of the Directorate of Operations, a newly minted paramilitary officer. I was informed that my first assignment was to go to Thailand, where I would pick up a group of North Vietnamese agents, train them in small unit tactics and sabotage before we were all parachuted into the Indonesian jungle. This was early in 1952, more than 2 years before the French defeat at Dien Bien Phu. I had the temerity to ask what our mission would be and was curtly informed that I would be given this information just before jumping out of our transport plane. At the age of 24, having gone through long months of training, it never occurred to me to refuse the assignment. Such was the wild and woolly atmosphere that prevailed in those days. Fortunately for me, the ethnic Vietnamese I picked up in Bangkok were not what they pretended to be, and the operation imploded. My life expectancy increased, and I was assigned to CIA's training base in Saipan. On that beautiful island, teams of agents from several Asian countries were trained for extremely hazardous and ill-thought-out missions in their home countries. Few were ever heard of again. As president, Dwight Eisenhower came to believe that Allen Dulles was also pulling the wool over his eyes about the covert operations of CIA, just as Walter Beadle Smith had come to believe before him. And at the end of his presidency, during the same week that he warned the nation, you'll remember this too, about the military-industrial complex and the disastrous rise of misplaced power, at the final meetings of the National Security Council, he bemoaned the fact that he had fought an 8-year struggle to organize American intelligence and had been defeated, and that he would hand his successor, John F. Kennedy, a legacy of ashes. And 4 months later came the Bay of Pigs. Ever since the Bay of Pigs, the CIA has been exquisitely sensitive to presidential command and control. And there was a myth or a misunderstanding that got out during the Church Committee hearings in the 1970s from the chairman of that committee, Frank Church, investigating the CIA, who wondered aloud if the CIA was a rogue elephant trampling people and nations. He was quite wrong about that. With few exceptions in the 1950s, and certainly ever since the Bay of Pigs, when people and nations got trampled, it wasn't the elephant. It was a rogue mahout, the elephant driver. And that was the President of the United States. Presidents have wanted to use the CIA as a silver bullet to solve problems. Action today, action this day, as Winston Churchill used to say. Covert operations take years to develop. You can't just turn a country around or, as Richard Nixon ordered the CIA to do in 1970 reversed the results of an election in Chile that had already been held. Okay. Presidents don't want answers 5 years from now. They will be out of office 5 years from now. They know what the graph of a presidency looks like. Time, power. They want action this day. CIA can't do that because that's not what CIA was set up for. It was set up to gather information for the United States about what's going on in the world. Not to change the world, but to know the world. And that is a tall assignment. In the 1960s, the CIA had a chance to develop to become what it was supposed to be. And in a high watermark of speaking truth to power, told President Johnson repeatedly that the war in Vietnam could not be won by military means. President Johnson didn't want to hear that. But the analysts got through to him, they got through to McNamara, and they convinced both of them. I think they finally convinced LBJ that the war could not be won, and I think that is part of the reason that he stepped down and did not run for re-election in 1968. That is speaking truth to power. The only thing that the CIA absolutely could not do in Vietnam was to know the intentions of the enemy, to break into Hanoi, to get into Hanoi, to know the mind of Ho Chi Minh. That they could not do. From this high water point of speaking truth to power, CIA fell and fell hard because Richard Nixon hated, rebuked, and scorned the CIA, mistreated it, and abused it. When Nixon and Kissinger went off to deal with the Russians and the Chinese and the North Vietnamese, they didn't tell the CIA what they were doing. That is no way to run a railroad. Nixon wanted to use the clandestine service, in his words, to hit the Soviets and hit them hard, but he was never satisfied with the results. And in the end, it was his illegal misuse of the CIA, not just spying on Americans, but his attempt to use the CIA to shut down the FBI's investigation of the Watergate break-in that led to his fall from office. President Ford had only been in office for a couple of months before he confronted a catalog of violations of the CIA's charter, compiled by the CIA itself. This is the list of attempted assassination plots, spying on Americans, that we now know as the family jewels. Ford sacked his DCI, Bill Colby, for trying to make a clean breast with Congress, and chose a very interesting director of Central Intelligence, George Herbert Walker Bush, a potential rival for the 1976 nomination for the Republican presidency. Bush thought this was going to be the end of his political career, but he found that he loved CIA, and he really did a lot to right the ship. He just loved the place. It was like Skull and Bones with a $1 billion budget. And he did a great deal in his 11 months to set the ship straight. I recently had a chance to ask Jimmy Carter about a conversation he had with Bush after Carter had been elected down in Plains, Georgia, but before he was sworn in. Bush the elder came down and he wanted to keep his job. And Carter smiled when he remembered this, and he said, "I've often wondered what would have happened if I had reappointed him. He never would have been elected president of the United States." Now, Carter had condemned CIA as a national disgrace, but in office he tried to use it to further his foreign policy, which was based on human rights. And the CIA did as good a job as it could, turning on a dime here. The Helsinki Accords of 1975 talked about the free movement of people and ideas. This was a weak chink in the Soviet armor. And Carter tried to hit him. And Bob Gates, our present Secretary of Defense, has offered the opinion that Carter tried to use the CIA to overthrow the Soviet system through Samizdat, that is secret writing, through books, through cassettes, the free movement of people ideas, getting Soviet dissidents out and getting dissident ideas into the CIA, into the Soviet Union. And the CIA had some success in this. I asked Carter about this too. He said, "Well, I didn't want to abolish their system, but I did want to alter it." And they had some success. In Gates's view, this was the beginning of the end of the Cold War. Now, a full accounting of U.S. intelligence under President Reagan cannot be written yet, in large part because President George Bush the younger has halted the declassification of presidential materials, or slowed it down considerably. But the fact, one fact about the CIA under President Reagan has been evident for 20 years. If you want to run a secret service in an open American democracy, you need trustworthy people in charge. And that means you don't hire Bill Casey, who had been Reagan's campaign manager, a creator of tax shelters on Wall Street, a veteran of the OSS during World War II. He tried to revive the spirit of Wild Bill Donovan. And we wound up, and I still don't believe this happened, selling weapons to the Iranian Revolutionary Guards to ransom hostages, taking the profit, skimming it, and giving it to the Contras in Central America. That's not intelligence, nor is it intelligent. The result of this was that Judge William Webster became head of the CIA, and he moved the CIA halfway down Pennsylvania Avenue and co-located it between the White House and the Congress. This hasn't worked out too well because Congress has not fulfilled its responsibility of overseeing the CIA. As you all know, there's two meanings to the word oversight: oversee and oversleep. And for most of the last 20 years, Congress has not fulfilled its responsibility in taking care that we have a first-rate intelligence service in this country. I mentioned that there was a high water mark of speaking truth to power in CIA's history. Another came during the presidency of George Bush the Elder, when Bob Gates, again our Secretary of Defense, ran the CIA. For 14 months, from late 91 to early 93, the CIA really hit on all cylinders. There was a lot of good reporting coming from the crumbling Soviet Empire. And this helped us keep our powder dry, helped end the Cold War without firing a shot. We did not go dancing on the rubble of the Berlin Wall. We kept cool because, in part, CIA was getting good information to the White House. All the more remarkable the contempt that George Bush the younger has shown for the CIA. George Tenet, in his memoir, described the CIA that he inherited in 1997 as, quote, a burning platform. Now think about this. You're on an oil rig in the North Sea. It's night. The sea is stormy, and your rig's on fire. He did not share this foreboding with the American people, but he did share it with President Clinton. George Tenet wrote in a secret report to the president not long after he took over CIA, that unless we change the way that we gather and analyze intelligence in this country, that CIA was, and the United States, was going to suffer a, quote, catastrophic systemic intelligence failure, unquote. The date of that report was September 11th, 1998. The failure did not happen 3 years later. The catastrophic failure that Tenet warned against was the Weapons of Mass Destruction report that came a year after 9/11, when the CIA told first the White House, then the Congress, and then through Colin Powell, the United Nations and the world, that Iraq was bristling with chemical and biological weapons. The CIA's intelligence in that report was 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 years old. It had no fresh intelligence after December 1998. And we are still recovering from that disaster. About a year into the war, in July 2004, when things were starting to go bad in Baghdad, President Bush was asked, well, didn't the CIA warn you that things could be a little dicey in a post-Saddam Iraq? And the president said, well, the CIA said things could be great. They said things could be lousy. They were just guessing, quote unquote. And with that casual remark, the president cut the CIA's throat. Just guessing is not intelligence. It was in this period that the Congress and the White House decided to disestablish the Office of Director of Central Intelligence. It had always been two jobs, being the CEO of the CIA and being the chairman of the board of all American intelligence agencies, of which there are now 16. No one had ever been able to do that job. So now you have a CIA that is no longer first among equals in the American intelligence universe, being run by General Mike Hayden. And then you have, you know, this orchestra of 16 different instruments and a conductor, Mike McConnell, trying to orchestrate it and make harmony instead of cacophony. Can we do it? A reporter, a French reporter, once got up to Hanoi in the mid-60s and asked Ho Chi Minh, "Ho, what do you think about the French Revolution?" And Ho said, "It's too early to tell." So I think it will take another generation before we know whether this new system is going to work. In the meantime, the next administration needs to do what it takes to create a new cadre of intelligence officers in this country who are linguistically and culturally fluent in all those hard languages that bring down your grade point average. These officers need to know how to operate abroad, and they are going to have to recruit foreigners to work for the United States from the nations of Islam at a time when the public image of the United States in those countries is at an all-time low. The recruitment, both of Americans who are willing to serve 20 years in anonymity for their country, and their recruitment, in turn, of foreigners who are willing to commit treason on behalf of the United States to betray their countries, their armies, their groups, their religions, their principles, to work for us. That is how we will win or lose this war that we are now in. It is no longer being called the War on Terror by the White House. They're now calling it the Long War. I think it will last as long as the Cold War. And I think we will win it or lose it by virtue of our intelligence. Thank you.
As many of you know, the CIA has published on its website a series of quarrels that it has with Tim Weiner's book. And on the front page of the New York Times today is an article in which the director of Central Intelligence is questioning the efficacy and the usefulness of the Office of the Inspector General. So there's a lot going on. We're fortunate to have today to sort of initiate our conversation with Tim Weiner, a man who served as Inspector General of the CIA under both the George H.W. Bush administration and the Bill Clinton administration, Fred Hitz. Fred, would you join us? Fred, as someone who has been there, how valid is the criticism that the CIA has launched on Tim Weiner's book, Legacy of Ashes?
I think there's been largely, at least in the press writings about Tim's book, enormous admiration for the work that he's done. The only criticism that I have seen is that in telling it, and telling it authoritatively, it comes through as being quite harsh, which it has to be in many ways, but it doesn't really make the point that Tim made in his remarks this morning, that there were a lot of highly motivated people who joined up in 1951 at the time of the Korean War, and of course earlier, with the best of motives, the Don Greggs of this world, and did what they were assigned to do, even if it was something that in the end turned out to be not very efficacious. And that's not the kind of book Tim was writing, but I think that's the criticism that I've seen that probably has more weight to it than the other. The point I wanted to ask him to amplify on, though, in his remarks and in the book, is this rather astonishing statement, which he backs up, that on several occasions, directors of Central Intelligence misled the President of the United States, the person for whom they're working. The CIA, as Tim pointed out, under Harry Truman's view, it would deliver the daily newspaper of things he had to worry about, and it would get it in some kind of order so he didn't have to figure it out for himself. He depended upon that distillation of information in order to guide him and his senior advisors in their assignment. That relationship between the director, whether it was actually man on man, face on face, has really existed throughout the 60-year history. Nobody else is going to defend CIA. It doesn't have a military-industrial complex keeping it going. It doesn't have a Council on Foreign Relations to support its policy pronouncements. It's the President of the United States. So this really remarkable point that Tim made earlier, where if you speak truth to power, there are two sides of it. There's the speaker and the recipient, is critical to the functioning of that relationship. And Tim points out in his book that on several occasions, directors literally weren't untruthful with the President of the United States.
There are two exemplars of this problem, and they are Alan Dulles and Bill Casey, both of whom were veterans of the OSS, who served under Wild Bill Donovan, and who knew what their mission was in World War II. It was to fight the goddamn Nazis. And they knew what their mission was in the Cold War. It was to fight the goddamn communists. And they saw the Cold War as a real war in which there were no holds barred. And to protect and defend the agency in times of crisis, they were not fully forthcoming with the President of the United States. They withheld information. And in Alan Dulles' case, misled the President about several operations, including the disasters in Korea, and including the involvement, against the President's wishes, of Americans in a covert operation to overthrow the government of Indonesia in 1958. With Bill Casey and Ronald Reagan, again, the record is not entirely complete. Casey mumbled and Reagan was hard of hearing. So that the notion of speaking truth to power is more fully complicated by those two facts. Nonetheless, there isn't any question that Casey was less than fully honest with the President about a number of his dealings abroad. And this, let it not be forgotten, came fairly close to ruining the presidency of Ronald Reagan in the fall and winter of 1986. Which is quite an accomplishment.
How valid is the criticism that the Director of Central Intelligence has launched on that office, and what does need to be done to improve the operation of that office?
I don't know the answer to the first question, because I don't know what I read in the paper today, just as some of you may have done, what the issue purports to be. What I was objecting to, what I would object to, what I'd like Tim's analysis of. This is a very odd relationship itself. We've talked about President and Director of Central Intelligence. The Inspector General is a presidential appointment. President appoints him. But the chain of command runs through the Director of the Central Intelligence Agency. In other words, everything that the Inspector General does and reports goes to General Hayden, except for an investigation of General Hayden's office itself, in which case it would go to the President and the congressional overseers at the same time. It strikes me that it's awfully hard. We all know that we have to watch the watchers. But it strikes me as unusual for the Director of Central Intelligence to gin up his own team to look at what might be wrong with the Inspector General, without thinking that this will have some impact on the Inspector General's ability to do his job generally, the regular inspections, audits, and investigations that he's required to perform according to his statutory duty. There is a way to deal with that. The President has something called the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. It's changed names a number of times since it was created in the 60s. But there is an intelligence oversight board part of that. distinguished citizens with some experience in the law and accounting and in the real world who can be charged by the president. We're getting complaints about the way the IG at CIA is doing his job. Would you look into it and report back to me? That takes it out of the hands of the person for whom the IG is primarily responsible, his management role, that is the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. A second way is there is at the level of the Office of Management Budget, and I know this is arcane, it's Washington wiring diagrams, but called the President's Council on Efficiency and Integrity, and it's sort of a bund of other inspectors general where one of their number is under examination for his practices. They can assign sitting inspectors general to go and look at the matter and report on it, presumably objectively. So what I'm complaining about is, if it's true that the director of the Central Intelligence Agency is checking up on the CIA inspector general, I think that's the wrong way to go. We ought to give it to an impartial third party.
What's going on here is that on the 17th of September 2001, the President of the United States, 6 days after the 9/11 attacks, told the CIA and the NSA, that does electronic eavesdropping, that the gloves were off, that under the unitary powers of the presidency as commander-in-chief, they were going to do whatever it took to prevent a follow-on attack. And this placed a number of officers of the clandestine service overseas in time in a rather perilous position. I will give you a hypothetical. The officer is down in the basement of the Mukhbarat, the Egyptian secret police in Cairo. He's got a suspected terrorist in a cage. He's got his counterpart from the Egyptian intelligence service standing next to him. They're going to beat the holy bejesus out of this guy. And the officer gets on the phone and I hope something more secure than a cell phone, and calls back to headquarters and say, what am I allowed to do? Can I beat the bejesus out of this guy? Does my friend Ali have to do it? Can I take the information if Ali does the beating and interrogation? This is what it boils down to. This is what it's like. And the officer is putting his career on the line if he makes a mistake. And the inspector general has been critical of the guidance, I think, that has been given, because we are in uncharted territory here, folks, about what we as a nation can do under the laws of God and man.
Would you comment on the genesis of the notion of extraordinary rendition and tell us if any information that was useful has ever been gathered by this means? And in general, how they assess this sort of information?
Yes, I'm going to testify on this, as a matter of fact, next week in the House of Representatives. The issue is, and I feel very strongly about it, the issue of rendition. And again, you're dealing with a buzzword. Grew up really in the first Bush administration after the passage of laws following the Achille Lauro hijacking, if you remember, in which Americans overseas, on the high seas or in sovereign territory of others, were subject to a terrorist act. They had been murdered. That became a federal crime. It based on our experience with similar kinds of situations, drug running in Mexico in particular, a famous case involving an agent called Camarera, in which the courts of the United States had said, if you can bring the alleged perpetrator before us, we're not going to ask you how he got here. And so rendition, that baffle-gab word, became a euphemism for snatching criminals overseas, or accused criminals overseas, and bringing them before American courts. And we did it with great success during the 90s. We got Ramzi Youssef, if you'll remember, in Pakistan with the help of the Pakistani government. We were able to acquire jurisdiction over several of the perpetrators of the bombings of Dar es Salaam and Nairobi in Kenya in 1998. And closest to my heart, of course, we were able to get the shooter outside the CIA gate, Mir Amal Khansi, who was a Baluchi who, after emptying the magazine of his AK-47, which he had bought in the neighboring Kmart, left the scene and flew back to Pakistan. With the help of the Pakistani government, the Bureau and the CIA were able to apprehend him. He was brought back to the United States, and he was tried in Fairfax County, a circuit court, and found guilty and executed. But it took on a new dimension, did rendition, in this period that Tim has described, where we took the gloves off after 9/11. And extraordinary rendition became the word that was used. And these were snatchings that took place based on evidence, however derived, from friendly foreign liaison services, friendly forces to our own. And we acquired jurisdiction over them. We grabbed individuals, but we transferred them to the control of third parties, the Egyptians in some cases, the Syrians and others, the Jordanians, whom we believed knew more about the culture, if there's an Arab being questioned, but may not have been bound by the same rules and constraints that the U.S. was. And I can give you an example that we all ought to read more about here, although it's not been well covered. And that's the case of Maher Arar, A-R-A-R, who was a Canadian, a dual Canadian-Syrian citizen, who based on bad information, let me underscore that, bad information from the Canadian Royal Canadian Mounted Police, was declared a member of al-Qaeda and put on a watch list, so that when he returned from Tunisia on his way home to Toronto, he came via Zurich and Kennedy. At Kennedy, they took him off the plane and held him incarcerated for several days and eventually summarily deported him to Damascus via private plane to Amman and then car to the Syrian capital. They did this without telling the Canadian government, who had supplied them with the information that they were going to do this, and against Canada's request that he be repatriated to Canada. In Damascus, he was thrown into a cell the size of a coffin, beat with an electric cable for over 2 weeks until the Syrians determined that he didn't have anything to say. And in a year's time, thanks to the strong prosecution of his case by his wife in Canada, he was eventually released and returned to his home. He's now in British Columbia, pretty much out of it, but at least he's got $7 million in compensation for his suffering. The United States still has him on a watch list. We've never acknowledged that the information was bad. And it just strikes me that in terms of both the treatment, the fact that we are rendering or delivering suspects to third parties whom we know are not going to follow our rules is a bad business, and it ought to stop. Now, why this is an issue is because under the Detainee Treatment Act that was passed a year or so ago, the standard for the U.S. military became the rewritten Army manual on how you deal with prisoners. And it's the point that Tim was making. Guidance has to be clear on this. You're at the end of the line, you're with a marabout, and you've got a guy in front of you whom you think has information. How do you get it out of him, coach? According to the Detainee Treatment Act and the Army manual, the techniques you will use will not be violative of international customary law. Cruel, inhuman treatment is not permitted.
And the problem here and what this is all about is that the Inspector General of CIA noted that the conduct of CIA officers had violated that standard.
And even though there is daylight in the Detainee Treatment Act, in that it applies to the military and to U.S. establishments, hence secret prisons in a cooperating nation in Eastern Europe or wherever are not seemingly covered by it, it is the understanding of the major sponsors of this legislation that in point of fact there is one standard in the United States, and that's the Army Field Manual. So this is a battle that's going to have to go forward, and in the back of your mind, and in certainly in implicit in the president's argumentation for it, is the fact that there are techniques out there that are not covered in the Army Field Manual, but do not constitute torture, which are open to the CIA to use. And let me make one plea as a 25-year veteran of CIA. The people who pay the price for this, if things go wrong, are not going to be the people in Washington that drafted the memorandum memoranda that tell them what to do. It's going to be the grunt in the field, just as it is for the military, who has laid hands on such and such a person or turned such and such a person over to the Syrian authorities. There's the guy whose career is in a bad way. And let me give you an example. Many of you have followed in the press the case in Italy, where an Egyptian cleric was
rendered
to Cairo. Turns out he was released later. The 12 CIA officials who were brought before the bar or sought to be brought before the bar in Italy won't go, but they'll never travel to Europe again. Their careers are over. They're the ones that are signing up for insurance, private insurance, to gain legal representation when the balloon goes up. Sorry, that's a private rant.
Question. Could you comment or clarify as to the reasons why the Office of Special Plans were set up, allegedly by certain neoconservatives in the government? What was the purpose? What was the intent? Okay. Was its purpose?
You're speaking here of the bucket shop that was set up in the Pentagon under Rumsfeld. This was Doug Feith's shop, otherwise known as Feith-based intelligence. Every president and almost every Secretary of Defense winds up pounding the table and saying, God damn it, why can't CIA tell me, fill in the blank, and sets up his own bucket shop somewhere. This vice president and the past occupant of the Office of Secretary of Defense, Mrs. Cheney and Rumsfeld, had a barb-in for the CIA going back to the Nixon and Ford administrations. And were convinced that the intelligence they were getting wasn't good enough, or conversely, did not fit their preconceptions. So they set up their own bucket shop, to no great effect, except worsening the relationship between the White House and the CIA.
You spent a bit of time discussing the relationship and the deficiencies in the relationship between the FBI and the CIA. But what I find particularly more interesting is if you can maybe discuss the role of the State Department and why there's been kind of controversy between CIA and state over various issues, and if that maybe has as much relevance as the FBI does.
There is a
full disclosure, Tim. This is one of my students.
Great question, lad. There is a sort of Cold War classic answer to that and a post 9/11 answer, and I will try and be brief. Every president since Kennedy has found it necessary to remind the State Department and the CIA what the proper relationship is in an American embassy abroad. That is, the ambassador rules, okay? And the station chief works for the ambassador, full stop. However, the conditions in the host country may alter
this ideal relationship. If the country is a civilized country and the foreign minister is more powerful than the interior minister, then it'll work. But if the country is not a nice country, and the interior minister or the head of the secret police or whoever the chief bad guy is more powerful than the foreign minister, then sometimes the station chief becomes more powerful than the ambassador because he's getting better information, he's more connected to the levers of the host government, and he knows more about what's going on, frankly. Also, there have been, in past administrations, ambassadorships for sale to political hacks in consideration of $250,000 contribution to the campaign of the sitting president. No station chief gets his job that way.
My question has to do with what I thought was fascinating, your description of the large amounts of money in the Marshall Plan that went for covert purposes. When did that become clear? I remember studying it in the 60s, and I know I would have remembered it if that had been out then.
Although this process has largely ground to a halt, temporarily, we hope, in the early 1990s, largely as at the initiative of Bob Gates, then director of Central Intelligence, there was a brief but glorious golden age of declassification at CIA. And among the many documents that got out was a, I believe 1948, is either late 48 or early 49, document by Frank Wisner, the chief of the clandestine service, detailing the mechanism by which this worked. Now, the Marshall Plan granted roughly $13 billion to our friends in Europe and a couple of countries in Asia. This money had to be converted from dollars to the local currency, okay? 5% of that converted currency was set aside and slipped into the operational pockets of CIA. The budgetary function for Frank Wisner's office, which was the arm of the CIA that did things in the late 40s and early 50s before Walter Beadle Smith pounded it into shape and set the CIA's architecture pretty much as it is today, was the funding mechanism for Wisner's covert operations was Marshall Plan money. There was a lot of it.
Good Tim, answer. As a final question, every one of us in the room knows that thousands of times each day, whenever we send an email, whenever we visit Google, whenever we go to an ATM machine, whenever we use EasyPass, we're leaving digital footprints all over the place. Does America have to turn into a surveillance state? Does all of that information have to be sifted through by the government in order to make us safe from terrorists?
This is an American problem, not a CIA problem. Okay? CIA has its hands full dealing with what's going on overseas. All right? By its charter, it is not supposed to spy on Americans, although, in the words of General Hayden, it does today have chalk on its spikes. We have to decide as a nation, and this will be a question for the next administration, whether we want to reorder the way we live, the fundamentals of our Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and the way we conduct ourselves as a people as a consequence of 9/11. As faithful readers of this book know, I often like to quote General Eisenhower. My respect and appreciation for him grows with the passage of time. He warned us in his last State of the Union speech against the disastrous rise of misplaced power in the military-industrial complex. Now, he got some last-minute advice to change that from the military-congressional-industrial complex. That's just a footnote. We have to be very careful in this country that we do not create a terror-industrial complex. We are getting awfully close. The intelligence budget, this is not just CIA, but all intelligence, has gone up to somewhere between $50 and $60 billion a year. CIA can't hire people fast enough, okay, to spend that money. Half of the people at CIA, half the analysts, and close to half of the operations officers today have been hired since 9/11. They have less than 5 years' experience. They are trainees by the CIA's own standards. So the CIA, in order to get the job done, is outsourcing the work. It's got all this money, but it hasn't got enough people. So who's getting the work? Lockheed Martin is getting the work. And SAIC. Lockheed Martin has a job posted recently on its website for a counterintelligence analyst. Okay, $90,000 a year, college degree preferred. The job is an interrogator at Guantanamo. We should be on our guard.
It's your next book.